Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello there. Welcome to today's New Books in Education, one of the podcast channels in New Books Network. This is your host, Pengfei Zhao, speaking to you from Gainesville, Florida. Our guest for today is Yilin Chang, Associate Professor of Sociology at National Zhengzhi University in Taiwan, the author of Study Gods, How the New Chinese Elite Prepare for Global Competition, published in 2022 by Princeton University Press. When a colleague of mine first introduced me Yilin's new book, I was very curious about its title, Study Gods. Who are they? What stories do they have? And why are they called Study Gods? Yilin's book did not disappoint me at all. In fact, I was so impressed by her refreshing, extensive, and sophisticated description of the life of elite Chinese adolescents, some of whom were named Study God because of their effortless abilities to achieve high academic performance. Very few of us understand how elite individuals and families operate in everyday life to maintain their privileged status. Study Gods offers a rare look into this issue. It is a book built on solid, long-term ethnographic research. Today, I will be talking with Yilin on her new book. In what follows, you will be hearing not only her fascinating findings on how Chinese elite youths achieve academic excellence and excel in a globalizing era, but also behind-the-scenes stories from a seasoned ethnographer, from how she interacted with these young people, to why she thinks it is important to understand the world of the elites. Now, let's turn to Yilin. Hello, Yilin. Welcome to New Books in Education. First of all, congratulations on publishing your new book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Before we dive into the book, would you like to say maybe just a few words about you, your work, what kind of work you do?
Great. Thanks. Hello, everyone. My name is Yilin Chang. I am a sociologist in Taiwan. My research focuses on education stratification and intergenerational status transmission in Greater China, meaning China and Taiwan, basically. I'm an ethnographer, but I also do some quantitative work. So within these research interests, I'm particularly interested in family background and cultural capital and how they shape students or children's educational outcomes, is primarily among the elites.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm sure we will talk different aspects of your work. But now I can't wait to dive into the book itself. I know from reading it, it's actually a crystallization of your multiple years of hard work, primarily ethnographic work. So I'm just curious to know a little bit about how you felt when you first saw the physical copy of the book.
Oh my God, it was the best thing ever to have arrived in the mail, seriously.
Oh really, so, wow.
Yeah, I got the book last year in 2022. That was exactly 10 years after I started the project. So amazing. I started, I packed up and moved to China, specifically Beijing in 2012, started following students, track them everywhere around the world. It was just incredibly nice to have the results of a decade of hard work to materialize. And of course, not to mention the book cover is quite sexy.
Yes, yeah, it was really appealing. And I literally just, you know, dive into it right away after Yale University, like the press. I think it's a Chicago University Press.
Princeton.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. the Princeton University Press sent this copy to me. You know, too many ethnographic good books. Well, maybe we can start it by talking about some of the general ideas that you share in the book. What kind of story did you tell in this ethnographic research? You mentioned you were following a group of elite students in Beijing, China. Tell us more about it.
So Study Gods is basically a book about how elite students in China learn to achieve and how they justify their fantastic outcomes. I primarily use ethnography or 8 years of follow-up, and also I think over 100 interviews. I stopped counting after 100. This book shows that Chinese youth learn important lessons during their preparation for college, that will later on help their pursuit of elite status. So the three most important lessons are, first of all, they need to understand the status systems. So they need to recognize and acquire the characteristics that each status system values, and they need to avoid the characteristics that are not valued. And then secondly, they need to have status-based behaviors, meaning that their daily interactions with peers, teachers, parents, basically everyone around them, is guided by these expectations and performances that are all surrounding status in school. And lastly, with the help of their resourceful parents, they need to learn how to use and manipulate external assistance to face potential obstacles and failures, meaning that they really need to have backup plans at all times. And so in the follow-up, also in the book, I look at how these students hone these skills wherever they go as they head to colleges and careers around the world, and how these lessons have helped foster their relationships with colleagues, supervisors, and of course, their parents over the years.
Well, interesting. So what are, like, who are these youth, these adolescents? How did you get to know them and how did you meet them? Can you say a little bit more about them?
Yeah, sure. I can't tell you exactly who they are, of course.
Oh, of course, yes.
Students through introduction of family friends into top high schools in Beijing. And so when I went to the schools, I had to meet with the principal or like a headmaster of the senior year 12th graders. And then I would explain my research agenda, what I'm trying to look at, and then they would assign me to certain classrooms upon the teacher's consent, and then I could go into the classrooms and meet these students. So I met them basically by being a researcher, but they usually call me a big sister because I went to school with them for a year and a half. I met them in the mornings and stayed up all night with them. We went to lunch, we shared meals, we talked about exams, we talked about basically everything in life. That was very intensive fieldwork during those days.
Wow, indeed. So you also mentioned the importance of status. I wonder if you could unpack that a little bit more. What kind of status is in their life, for example, or if they move up from, you know, high school to college, and then if they left their college, move to a work setting, what does that mean to navigate these different types of statuses? Status systems.
Wow, this is a really good question. It's also a big one. So
sure.
I think there are status systems everywhere. Just and in every system, there are people who occupy the top notch, the top group, and there are people who are not among the top group. So elite really is meaning people who are perhaps top 10%, top 5%, or even top 1% in any society or in any social group. The elites in my study or in study gods is the high social economic status students, meaning that they come from very wealthy families. So I primarily use a social economic definition of the elite. These students are elite because they have wealthy parents who have top 5% income in all China. And then they later on, after they go to work, since some are working now, they also have very high income themselves. Most of them working in the US or UK have top 10% income by the age of 24. Those who are married have a combined family or household income that puts them in the top 1% in the American income bracket. And so the definition of elite really is primarily based on money, I hate to say, but the ways that they achieve elite status is primarily by getting very good education or like being enrolled or testing into top schools, top universities, not just in China, but also around the world.
And that's why this ethnographic work is primarily based in schools.
Yes, because education is usually a very good way for the elites to maintain status, justify their status outcomes.
Well, you know, then I would wonder why you want to study elites, for example. I wonder why it's important for us, the maybe the bottom 98% or the bottom 99% of the whole population understands elite's life and how they struggle or how they manage to stay at the very top of this social pyramid.
Mm-hmm. So I started wanting to look at the elites because there wasn't too much about them. In sociology, I read a lot about the working class, the poor, and also there are increasingly many studies about the middle class, but then there wasn't that many studies on elites. One reason was because that scholars rarely get to go into elite spaces because, you know, we're not elite, we're not rich, we don't earn that much.
No, we're not, not at all.
Right, so I think this was a gap in the literature. If we wanted to understand society, everyone in society is part of society, and this includes the elites. But then when I dived into the very small elite literature at the time, of course it's expanding now, but at the time there weren't that many studies. And when I looked at most of these studies, they were primarily focused on Western countries. And I looked at them and I watched and I found that they were really interesting, but they didn't really speak to my understanding of the very wealthy, the affluent in Taiwan or in China or in East Asia are the ones that I know about. And so I thought I wanted to take this perspective and apply it on a non-Western country and see whether the theories we know still hold. And while doing this research, I gradually came to realize that studying elites is actually incredibly important for social equality. Like the elites can change society in ways that the bottom 99% cannot. They have greater say in a lot of economic policies, not to mention tax issues. They also are known to change the status systems according to their interests. So for example, so using the example of education is actually a really good example. In the US, we know that elites have been changing the educational system. At first, when universities and Ivy Leagues admitted students, they primarily admitted the elite class. And then afterwards, other students, not of the WASP elites started getting admissions into these elite schools. So the elite class, the WASP elite class at the time, then changed the entire system of how admissions was to be conducted. Instead of using test scores and then being out applied by the Jewish community or Jewish students, they then decided on using the holistic student characteristics as the primary way for university admissions. And this is what we have right now. So American universities use a holistic admissions system, but that was actually used for the elites to send their children into these top-notch universities. And so this is why I think elites matter. We need to know about them, what they're doing and what they're interested in, and how, especially how they justify and maintain their privilege around the world.
Well, that makes so much sense to me. I mean, I listened to me, especially when you brought up the point about how the study of elites are primarily based on the studies conducted in Western countries, but we know very little about how elites, you know, they grew up maybe, or they managed to stay at the top 1% in non-Western societies. You know, I think in that sense, China has a very unique case, because, you know, the group of young people you studied, they have a life that is very different from their parents or grandparents. For example, China has undergone these very radical social changes over the past several decades, and the way how their parents or grandparents led their life nowadays has been, maybe already is outdated from the newer generation's point of view. So I wonder if you would like to unpack a little bit about the intergenerational differences here. And also, as you said, you know, the statuses about being what is counted as elite has been constantly changing in the Chinese context as well.
Right. So the students and study gods are a unique generation, just as you said. To me, these students are among the first generation in mainland China to have grown up in stable society without large-scale revolution, without
large-scale policy,
famine, no war.
And that was also what I was thinking about when I asked you this question, because if you think about their parents and grandparents, they went through, you know, World War II or the Cultural Revolution or some other political movements. Yeah,
so these students are really the first generation in mainland China to pursue status as a reproduction and not mobility. Their parents, as you said, went through a cultural revolution, but they actually went to university after a cultural revolution, like in the early 80s. And so they are a generation that achieved upward mobility through education. And of course, their grandparents then went through the war, there was famine, they were not as well off as their as the parent generation, and the parents are now trying or doing whatever they can to make sure that their children does as well, at least as well as how they are doing. So this is a really interesting generation, just by looking at their trajectories. But in addition, they're also part of the one child policy generation. So in that case, as part of the one child policy, urban girls and boys sort of have achieved equivalent status because parents could no longer choose the gender of the child. And so these children are born in the 90s. So their parents have only one child to invest in, and that is them. And so it's really interesting to see how these parents, who themselves were upwardly mobile, are doing whatever they can to pass down the privileges that they worked so hard for to the children's generation.
Well, that's very interesting, because like that's also what I've been seeing. Well, I don't know if you have notice that, but my own study is about the older generation, is about the generation who achieved the upward mobility. And then we are seeing how their children were doing right now. So we are like trying to depict this larger scale landscape in terms of intergenerational differences, in terms of these societal social status system. I found what is appealing about the book is this back and forth, actually, between the macro level analysis about the, you know, all of these systems, and then the very interpersonal level accounts of their peer relationship, their interactions at schools. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that in terms, maybe we can start from the peer relationship, because the idea of study gods is actually from how they call their peers if they are superior, right?
Yes, I should probably define study gods. So the definition of a study god, which is the literal translation of 学生,
yes,
is that these students are very high achieving, they get incredibly high test scores, but they don't seem to be working very hard. Yes. So these are considered like the geniuses of the cohort or of the school, and students kind of worship them. So in peer interactions, we see that, let me give you an example. The example I like most is Claire. Claire is a study god. She is very, very high performing. She doesn't really study that much. She had time to have a boyfriend. She could do other things. She was interested in a lot of things, but primarily she was the top performing student in the school. So people adored and worshiped Claire. They memorized her SAT score and her entire college application list. They knew what Claire was up to, at what times. They would not bother her if she showed any signs of distress. Basically, Claire was the star of the school. And in contrast to her was her classmate, Brandon, who people also liked, but Brandon was not top performing. He was thus not a study god. On the other hand, it's interesting to see that Brandon is more like a well-rounded person that American universities claim to like. Brandon is an athlete. He plays basketball very well. He is also a violin soloist who has performed in school concerts. He is also a genuinely helpful classmate. He helps his friends or his classmates with homework whenever he can in the subjects that he is good in. But then taken together, his test scores were never up there. And so even though people liked Brandon, he was not a study god, he was not worshipped, they didn't really care that much about what he did. They definitely did not follow him. They would never turn around to look at him if he passed through the hallways, but they would do so for Claire. And so this is not because Brandon is bad or anything. It's just that in my analysis, I find that this is primarily because Claire possessed the most important attribute in the status system, which was test scores, while Brandon did not. And so even with all the other characteristics that make him a wonderful friend, a nice person, he will not have high status because he did not possess that one important thing, and that was test scores.
But students also came up with different names for, you know, non-study god students. Like they have another name is called 学霸, right? 学渣.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm trying to bring up some of those terms that you introduced in the book.
Sure. So the hierarchy that I found in Chinese high schools was really a four-tier hierarchy. On the absolute top was the study gods, the people who don't really seem to be studying but have really high test scores. The second group was called the studyholics, which is a translation of 学霸. Studyholics are students who study a lot, and they also have very high test scores. So together, study gods and studyholics are the high status groups in the Chinese high schools that I went to. Moving on from the studyholics is the underachievers, which is a translation of 学渣. Underachievers are students who don't seem to be studying, and also they don't have high test scores. Not having high test scores, in fact, means the bottom 50%. So that is a quite generous definition of low test scores. But further below is the so-called losers. Students call these students losers because they study a lot and yet they still don't have high test scores. So losers in Chinese would be 学弱. And I have to say that I did not translate these terms. These terminologies came from the students themselves. And so I would not call anyone losers, of course, but the students did in daily conversation. While the study gods really is a literal translation, because that's the best term that captures the essence of being of the top status in those high schools.
So now I'm trying to imagine if I were one of those young people studying in one of those top-notch high schools in Beijing, how would I feel to navigate such a complex and clearly hierarchical system? How did they feel?
It was surprising for me that everyone seemed to support the system, regardless of where they were. I didn't think that the non-study gods would be motivated to support or sustain this hierarchy, but in fact, they were some of the most diligent supporters. They would correct other people for claiming status wrongfully, and they are also they also try to sort me and like everyone who they know inside the status system. So they were really adamant about it. They would, especially for the underachievers or the 学渣, they would try everything in their power to avoid falling down as a loser. So instead of trying to change the status system, they join in bashing the losers whenever they get the chance. When losers show mistakes in class or in tests that are revealed in public, they are the first to jump and shame them in public. They're also the ones who tell me primarily to avoid talking to losers on campus. They also help identify out losers. So this is really interesting. They don't really seek to change the system, but instead they uphold it by trying to maintain status. And for the study gods and the study holics, of course, they have high status. I don't think there is strong motivation for them to change the status system, so they could go about life as they please. People bow down to their wishes, not just peers, but also teachers and their parents. So, of course, they would have a fantastic, fabulous time in high school. That is, of course, not counting for the fact that they are studying about 12 to 15 hours every single day on one exam that will sort of, they think, will determine their future prospects.
So that's very interesting. That makes me think about, you know, why do you have any speculations about why the whole students' body seem to support the system? Or because like, you know, in some other studies conducted in China, we would see findings about, say, subculture, like youth subculture or youth rebellious culture, youth counter mainstream cultural behaviors. And here it seems that everyone is very mainstream. So I wonder why. Do you have any speculations on that?
Yeah, I have two reasons of speculation. The first is that in the more macro scale, these students are elite.
Yeah, so, I was thinking about this as well. Yeah.
It is within their interest to follow the current norm in society, the hierarchies that they themselves, their parents' generation, have sustained. So in general, they would probably have not that much motivation to change things to their so-called benefits, because in the grand scheme of things, things are of their benefits. And then when we zoom in into the schools, I don't think they could have changed even if they wanted to, because they are not the top status in school. They don't have that much power. They are still under the supervision of teachers. They still need to do as told most of the time. They need to prepare for the exam. They can't be frightening violent to other people, or there will be consequences. And when the entire school system and everything inside the campus is structured around test and test scores, more specifically, I think taken together, they decide to follow the rules by upholding status, knowing that in the future, other people will also uphold the status for them as they still get the chance to fight for elite status. After all of these students are in top schools. They are all top performing. The lowest performers still go into very good universities.
Wow, very impressive. Now I wonder, what about those teachers? If there are clearly hierarchies and different statuses among students, how do teachers support students from different statuses, for example? Or would the students from a lower status receive enough support from teachers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the first thing I have to mention is that teachers have never acknowledged the student hierarchy.
Yeah.
They don't call any student study gods or anything. They don't use those terminologies at all. But their interactions are systematically different between the study gods, study holics, versus the underachievers and losers. So teachers, they have incentive to uphold the high performers as much as possible because there is performance pay. So I think it could be the number of students that go into a top university or the proportion of students in a classroom that go to a top university. But either way, performance pay could go as high as to more than their annual income, depending on the results. Wow. And so there is a very clear motivation that drives teachers to let the high performers stay as high performing as possible. And by doing this, if the high performers demand things, then they will usually bow down to that because it is in both of their interests to let them stay high performing. With regard to the low performers or the not so high performers, teachers, of course, as educators, they seem to be trying to support them in any ways possible. However, things don't really work out the way that they plan. For example, teachers could pay special attention to the low achievers. They could ask them more questions in class, make sure they're following and pay more attention to their incorrect test answers, trying to correct the problem and let them do better in the future tests. But for the low performers, this creates tremendous stress. And this kind of is often turned into public shaming events by the other higher performers. And so teachers with all their good intentions are turned into, I wouldn't say minions because they're really important, but they turn into other adults who sustain this really unequal status systems through these peer interactions and classroom interactions. Of course, then some teachers might say that, oh, in that case, they should probably secretly help out the underachiever and losers. And some have. In one rare case, one teacher helped out a underachiever to apply for a certain grant or fellowship. But of course, the student didn't get it, but the student was in tears whenever He thought about the teacher being willing to help him in such a way. And so that actually had a really good impact on him. He later studied really hard and improved his test scores, moved up from the underachiever to the study-holics, and then went to a very good, one of the top Chinese universities. But this is asking for a lot from the teachers to secretly or subtly help the underachiever and losers. And of course, as educators, no teachers would say they'll just let the losers or underachievers fail. That's just not possible. But unfortunately, sometimes when they decide that it's out of their hands or they are no longer able to help, because these teenagers sometimes do have a very strong drive to go about on their own ways. In the unlikely event, although there are a few of them, then the teachers are forced to let go and let the students decide on their own what they want to do. Sometimes this doesn't have a very good outcome. One student was very headstrong. He decided on what schools he was going to apply for. His test scores, however, were never there. So in the end, he didn't get into any university. And this was a top high school where usually the matriculation to university rates were basically 100%. I asked this teacher, why did he let this happen? Because the teacher knew what the student was doing. He knew that the college applications was problematic. And he flatly blamed it on the student. He said that he's been trying to tell the student that his test scores weren't there, but the student never listened, implying that the student was headstrong, and that it also sort of confirmed that the teacher didn't do much on trying to change the student's course. But not because he didn't want to, but because it was immensely difficult and he could not.
Well, it sounds very complex here, the relationship, and, you know, not every good intention may lead to the best result in reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then what about those parents? Because like in your book, it feels like the parents play an important role, very important role in shaping their children's future. And sometimes, you know, I can't help but wondering, are they all helicopter parents?
That's a really interesting thought. The parents I found were all very devoted to their kids. Of course, just like the teachers, they never use these terminologies. They don't recognize a hierarchy because they don't really set foot in the campus anyway. But also in my observations, their interaction with their children also depended on test scores. And so, of course, all of the parents want their children to do as good, as well as possible on the exam, or even in their applications to American universities. In doing that, just like the teachers, they have motivation to sustain the high performers. The high performers could ask for their parents' credit cards to make online purchases with no parental supervision. And that was fine. That was a considerable degree of freedom, not just in money, but also in other ways, such as when one of the high performing students didn't do well on one test, she was really upset. And immediately the mom gave her a puppy that she had been asking for years. So this is a lot of from the parents just to maintain the children's demeanor and stuff. But then for the low achievers, the parents do a lot and try to amend the situation. They would try to help raise their children's test scores, such as by confiscating their phones, demanding them to go to certain tutoring for SATs or other stuff, or that they have to be constantly under the parental watch on weekends. They need to be studying, right? And so this actually is the opposite of experiencing freedom. And so, of course, just like the teachers, the parents have the best intention in mind. They are all, of course, thinking the best for their children, but not all of their performances were interpreted as kindly by the children. And so just as you said, we see helicopter parents there. These are the very hands-on parents, but then in among these elite students, mostly they are the parents of low performers, because the high performers' parents would just let go and let live, and their children are doing very well. Yeah, so that's kind of like an interesting small finding, like the tiger mother phenomenon. That is also not very prevalent among the elite, because the requirement for a mother to emerge as a tiger mother or even a tiger father, it has the premise that the student doesn't do really well in school. And so this is, I think this adds a little more nuance into the general finding of helicopter parenting or tiger mothering.
Indeed, and also says an interesting dialogue with, you know, the popular discourse maybe here in the United States about Asian parenting, for example, this idea of like Asian moms or Asian parents involved in intensive tiger mothering or tiger parenting. So that's a very interesting finding indeed. And so that makes me wonder, in terms of like the comparative comparative perspective, what do you see as the similarities and differences if we compare those Chinese elite adolescents, their life with the lives of adolescent elites, maybe in Western countries, in developed countries? Do you have anything you want to share with us about that?
Sure. Just to say, but just be cautious about what I'm going to say, because everything I know about the Western elite teenagers come from literature and students on Penn campus. So I think that their lives are definitely very different. In America, at least, because of all the well-rounded, the emphasis on well-roundedness, students could do a lot of things. They could demonstrate talent in multiple areas, but also their life is very busy juggling multiple activities. They need to do sports. They also need to participate in academics. They also need to do other arts and music. And so it's a lot of things that they need to do, and they only need to succeed in at least one. And so this is a sort of pressure for them. They're like busybodies going around in all sorts of directions, trying to figure out which one is the best for them and in which area they do best. Life in China is very different from that. There is one singular focus, which is the test scores. If students are going to a Chinese university, then it is the Gaokao test scores. If they're going to an American university, they focus on the SAT. And if not the SAT currently, I'm suspecting that they would focus on their GPA. They believe that this single criterion is the most important thing to getting into university, and then from there on building a rosy future. So with a single focus and versus the multiple focus, their lifestyles would be very different. Chinese students learn to focus and concentrate on one thing since young, and they have the ability to concentrate on that one boring thing that sometimes they dislike, yet they have the power, the willpower to go through all of that hurdle just for, even if they immensely dislike their lifestyle. But then on the other hand, they are only prepared for that one thing. These students have learned piano, violin, and other sports activities or art before they were in high school. But they, all of them actually gave it up because they needed to focus on test scores. So that is also a lost opportunity. Like, students could have been multidimensional. They could have developed well-rounded personalities, but instead they focused on one thing. Of course, there's pros and cons for each, like multidimensional talents versus the ability to strive through difficulty over long periods of time. I'm not sure which one is good, which one is bad, but it does create very different groups of teenagers. And it's interesting to see that how these teenagers will come into the same campus in the future or the same workplace and how they will compete against each other, as adults.
Right, indeed. So I wonder if you have any stories from their later life to share with us. When they eventually graduated from their high school and when they entered maybe an elite university in the United States like Penn, or finally entered their workplace to compete with global elites from other parts of the world. What does that look like for them?
Yeah, that is also part of my interest in doing the multi-year follow-up with these students. So when they went to universities, it was really interesting. The first thing was those 10 out of 28 students that I followed went to American or British universities, primarily American. So these students who went to American universities found themselves out-competing American students in classroom, in academics. Of course, they're honed in academics. So they get straight A's, they're doing very well on campus, they're fulfilling the model minority stereotype very well. And by then, they didn't need to change at all because there were, first of all, enough of them to form a group. So they still thought that test scores were really good. They sort of looked down on their American counterparts because they were higher performing than the the local Americans. They would ask me questions or give comments such as, why are they not doing this? Why are the American students not doing as well? Isn't this their native language? Or things like that. So they sort of maintained the same hierarchy among themselves, at least among the Asian group, or if not the Chinese group. The other students who stayed in China had a very different experience in the sense they were out-competed by students who came from villages or, populous provinces. And when these elites found themselves out-competed academically, the exact same thing that I mentioned earlier in America universities took place in China, they switched the hierarchy. They decided that it was more important to enjoy life than to study all the time. And so during those 4 years of college, they moved the underachiever into high status and switched the studyholics down, because studyholics didn't know how to enjoy life. They only knew how to study. And so the hierarchy changed because they were from Beijing. They were wealthy. They were the elite group, also in Beijing universities. And then afterwards, when both groups graduated university, interestingly, most of them went to the U.S. or Britain for graduate school. And so when they went to the U.S. or Britain again, they immediately switched, the students who came from China then immediately switched back to their old habit of using work performance or academic performance in graduate school as the main criterion to determining one's status in wherever hierarchy they are. If it was in graduate school, their performance, if they were going for academia, they already knew how many papers they submitted where it was important. They were competing very well. On the other hand, if the students went to work, primarily they were in fields such as finance or in engineering, they looked at work performance as the new test scores. And so they would compete on who gets the best cases, who brings in the most money for the company, who can write the best codes, or whose codes were finally used, who can lead the group project. And importantly, I thought this was all against the American ideal of a holistic personality or well-rounded personness, the team player ideology. But oddly, they were doing very well in work and in graduate school, especially in work. I guess this is because supervisors, in the end, like employees who bring in the most revenue and who has the best work performance. And these students, because there's, again, a lot of them, there's a sufficient number of them, they could team up and do group work. And that also creates a great, wonderful group dynamics, because they're all competing with each other, but in a friendly way and building each other up. And so they are competing very well in work and in workplaces against other nationals in the States. My fear, however, is that at around mid-career, they might not do as well because they might be very good employees, bringing in revenues, taking on good cases, bringing in customers. But then at the mid-level, when they become supervisors, it's not just about that kind of work performance. It requires a lot of other characteristics, teamwork, leadership, and the well-rounded personality might play a more important role. But again, these students are just 25, 26 at the moment, so they're not there yet. So their future really, what happens to their future really awaits. And I would be really interested in following them, even if not for research, then I could still look at how they're doing and how they should turn out.
Wow, that sounds so cool. And now I truly believe the importance of the multi-year follow-up part, because the story is so long. We want to hear the complete story. With that said, I'm thinking about, you know, what about those geopolitical frictions between China and primarily the United States over the past few years, but also different parts of the Western countries? So the political friction really has generated echoes and reactions on different levels. I'm wondering what you have seen from these former students about their reaction, how they experienced that.
Yeah, so when they went to the US, that was in 2013 and 2014. That was before or around the time when US limited student visa quotas for students in China, but it didn't say China at the time. It was primarily geared towards certain fields and subjects in which Chinese and Indians were the largest two groups. And so these students who successfully went to the States were essentially unaffected by that visa quota policy. By the time that they were graduating in 2017 and 2018, America once again limited the H-1B quotas for work. And so these students, some of them narrowly escaped the decrease in quotas, in visa quotas. Others were not that lucky. Those who are not that lucky then went to like Columbia or New York University or Cornell, places like or Harvard and MIT for a master's program. They thought that they would avoid the visa squeeze and maybe things will get better after 2 years or a year or so. And with a master's, they might be, you know, more competitive on the labor market. Unfortunately, these students who went to the master's programs graduated in 2020 or 2021 during the pandemic.
Yes, the pandemic came.
So the macro force in the world's trajectory were really against them. All of them who went for master's programs in the U.S. tried to stay in the U.S. for work. Very few of them succeeded. Almost all of them had to return to China, not just because the schools were shut at the time, but also the really high death rates. And then also, along with that, the visa quota never opened up either. And so a lot of these students were forced to return to China, while a few of them got jobs, and even fewer of them decided to go to a PhD because they couldn't get a job.
So a PhD in China?
No, in the U.S.
Oh,
so
okay.
The goal was to stay in the U.S. If they couldn't, they would go for further education.
Mm-hmm.
Only very few who decided not to, I'm sorry, only the very few did so, though. Most of the graduates at that cohort went back to China. And when I followed them, I texted and messaged them or Zoomed them, most of them said that they still had plans to return to the U.S. after the pandemic is over. None of them are as satisfied as their with their jobs currently, but they're really happy that they have a job right now. And so when I asked how they're going to return to the U.S., most of them said, well, they can apply directly for transfers within the company, hopefully. If there's no such option, then they will have to apply for a PhD in a good university in the U.S. So again, they're using education as a way to maintain status, but also to keep themselves in the loop for global elite competition through education.
Wow, walking against the wind is hard. Even for elites, it's still hard.
Yes, COVID was a real surprise for them and for almost all of us, I think, in the world.
Yeah, sure, yes. Well, now I sort of want to shift the gear a little bit, as we have talked a lot about their stories. And now I wonder if you could share a little bit about your own reflection about your story wisdom. I wonder, for example, if a novice researcher who is also very interested in working with elites or elite adolescents, what kind of advice would you give them nowadays, as you have finished the book and has maintained this long-term relationship? I don't know how you would call it, if you would call it a friendship with your elite participants.
Uh-huh. So for research purposes, I would advise them to be prepared. Be prepared for the kinds of surprisingly different interaction styles that elites have versus the non-elites. If the researcher is non-elite, then yes, they really absolutely have to be prepared. At first, when I encountered these elite students, I felt that they were incredibly entitled. They made comments on my appearance. They felt free to give suggestions on how to improve my body image. they also expected me to do a lot of things when they asked for. Of course, this is the high performers, such as they expected that upon request, I would take them to movies. Upon request, I would buy them lunch or dinner at a restaurant of their decision. And upon their request, I would help them get into the University of Pennsylvania because I was a graduate student there. Of course, this is incredible entitlement that basically had to be adjusted for. And of course, as a graduate student, I would never be able to help anyone get into my university. That's just not how the way things work. So it's kind of surprising on multiple levels, on the academic level, on the emotional level, and the psychological level. Studying elite young people requires a lot of self-adjustments. But then I think the most important thing is to stay interested and not be taken aback by all of these surprising entitlement or unpleasant or certain unpleasant interactions. I was really interested in them, and I think they felt it. They felt that I was no threat. I was really just there to see how they were doing. And I think they appreciate it, especially teenagers. They appreciate people putting them at the centerpiece of other people's lives. And for about 8 to 10 years, these students were the center of my life. I follow them around the world. I visited them in every single break that I had. My summers and winters and every other vacations were all spent trying to contact them. I remembered everything that I could about them. And so I think they do appreciate that a lot. But then that, of course, is also based on the researcher's very high emotional devotion to studying these elite young people. So overall, I think it has been a pleasant journey. And I think there really should be more people who follow elite adolescents or teenagers around. If not just for research purposes, understanding how they are, understanding what they're like, I think is really important. Not just for a broader understanding of how the world works, but also it helps us reflect on what we've done and what we could have done better if we were in that position.
Wow, that's such a strong commitment to your own work and to your participants as well. Thank you so much, Yilin, for sharing that with us. And now I come to almost at the end of my chat with you. I would like to ask what you're working on right now. Are you working on some new projects, starting a new ethnography, or still working with this group of young people?
I would have loved to follow them, but then I started working, so and also COVID broke out. So that the Study Gods project has come to a full end. But I am currently starting another ethnography on how elite universities in Taiwan choose their new students. So essentially is a study about admissions. I would be part of different committees on the admissions office, in the admissions office, and I would look at how other officers or faculty who serve on this team talk about students, discuss the student attributes and what is the most important thing to them. So essentially it's shifting from the perspective of students, teachers, and parents to the perspective of the elite universities, the institutions. Primarily what was driving this was that elite universities never say that we want students from, you know, wealthy backgrounds. We don't ever say that. Of course, there's legacy admissions, but we don't say it because they have money. No, definitely not. Instead, we use a lot of terminology and vague ways to express who we want and what kind of students we like. All of them, actually none of them are related to class. But in the end, every elite university takes in so many students from the wealthy upper classes. And so I would like to look at how this process unfolds by being on the admissions team. I'm really excited about that. My work has passed the Institution Review Board for Human Subjects. And I've also gained permission to serve on two different admissions teams in two different universities. Of course, that's also going to be labor intensive because the only reason they allowed me to join them was because they didn't have enough faculty who could help out. And so I plan to devote perhaps the next few years, 2 or 3, in gathering data about this admissions project. And then later on, hopefully I can work on another book to introduce how admissions actually work from also, again, a non-Western perspective.
Wow, that sounds another important study. And we look forward to having you back to talk about your new book, the second book.
Thank you. I hope so.
Well, thank you so much, Yilin. And we have taken so much time from you today. Again, thank you for sharing your wonderful study with us. We really appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for inviting. It was great talking.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.